Health IQ.
Health IQ. They are a great partner of Trail Runner Nation, and they look for good life insurance policies.
It's Health IQ. It kind of makes me think they're smart about health.
They are. They go to runners that are usually healthier. They found that healthier runners live longer. And what they've been able to do is negotiate better rates with the life insurance companies for us.
That makes sense. If you have a good driving record, your insurance is lower. So we're essentially have running records.
And you can capitalize on that by going to healthiq.com/TRN. That's healthiq.com/TRN.
And many trail runners don't even realize you can get a lower rate. So we encourage you to go out there. If you're already paying for life insurance or you're thinking you need some, this is the place to go. Now, many of you may or may not know, Scott Warr is a wizard, and where he practices
wizardry
is shipping out arm sleeves, buffs, shirts, and hoodies, and he does that for Trail Runner Nation.
You know, we've been overwhelmed by the popularity of these new sleeves and
they're
buffs.
Cool. They're cool.
They're really cool. We're coming into the cooler season here in the Northern Hemisphere, and frankly, I wore my arm sleeves and buffs as we were trail testing these things earlier in the summer when it was hot.
Right.
And I loved them even when it was warm outside.
And if you take a look at some of the Badwater runners that running in the super hot stuff, they are covered up and they're wearing armbands and sleeves and different things. So they're both made for cold or hot.
And we do ship around the globe. There's a lot of questions we get. Do you ship to South Africa? We ship everywhere.
BFE?
We actually have a zip code for BFE. We can do that. and so you can pick those up in the store. We visit the store. We'll actually be setting out some social media links. We have some new hoodies and some new T-shirts that are coming. We also have some really cool, I'm pretty excited about them, really cool hats that are coming. We do have a limited number of the pink, ultra pink TRN hats still available. And once they're gone, they're gone. We're not going to reorder those. But go to the TRN store and check out some of that swag.
Ladies and gentlemen of the wide, worldwide ultra running community, you are listening to nothing less than the greatest Trail Running Nation podcast on earth. It is the Trail Runner Nation podcast.
The problem with the message above is that it flies in the face of what we know to be true.
We'll
Candace, we are such idiots. You don't even you have no idea.
No, I've listened to your podcast for many years, and it's
I do own my own bar. every Friday morning on I Run Far, we open up and open up the taps.
You're recording this, aren't you, Freeman?
I get everything. Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warr.
Today we have Dr. Phil Maffetone, and what a pleasure it is to get to speak to Dr. Maffetone.
You know what? We were just talking the other day. It has been a long time,
way too long
since we've had Dr. Maffetone on the podcast. I should have gone back and looked to see how many podcasts we've done with him. It's got to be half a dozen.
You know, it's embarrassing to look back and see how long ago it was. That means we're not doing our job. Thank you, Dr. Phil, for coming
should
on.
You should be embarrassed. Don and Scott, it's always great to be with, you know, I have so much fun with you guys. Don't be strangers. Of course, I'm busier than I've ever been in my life. But there's always room to talk.
Let's make sure we dig into some of that busy stuff that you're doing. But for those of you that don't know, Dr. Phil Maffetone is also an author, and he is a musician, and he's many things, and a mentor and an inspiring coach for many. And
I think he's changed the way that you and I train and live.
And we'll talk a little
our
bit about
our diets
that.
And our training. I think that he's changed a lot of us.
Some of our favorite.
Scott, you've slimmed down from the last time we talked.
You have a good eye too.
So is
Don.
Yeah, we've got the slimming camera on. It doesn't cost much.
It's an app. It's an app on the
app,
Mac.
Yeah. Boy, wouldn't that sell? Hey, I gotta think about this.
Yeah.
if you want to get the big yellow book, Endurance Training and Racing by Dr. Phil Maffetone, another book, The Maffetone Method, the red book, Health and Fitness, the big red book, the Endurance Handbook written by Dr. Phil Maffetone, all of them good. And once you start to turn the pages, you just can't stop because there's just useful information in there for the endurance athlete. He understands.
It's good to read those books from cover to cover, but it's also even more beneficial to have them in your library as a reference.
Right.
So that when you're having some kind of an issue or you're trying to do something a little bit better, you can refer to those, especially the two big books. And there's just so much information in there. You can use it as a reference guide.
Dr. Phil, let's talk about slowing down to run faster. I mean, I don't think we can ever get enough of that. I know you address it all the time, but it's such a valuable discussion. And it's also on your philmaffetone.com website, where right from the start, want speed, slow down. And there you have an article on it. So let's touch on that a little bit. And maybe some people that are listening to this right now might even back off on their run and slow down a little bit.
if they're running, you are slow your cadence down.
You are permitted. So let's talk about that, Dr. Maffetone.
Man, that was the title of one of my first big publications. And I want to say it was 19... an article format, and I want to say it was 1983 maybe, or uh-huh. way back. And I think I've rewritten that several times. What you see on the website is the latest version, hopefully. And there may be certainly a section in the book, if not a chapter, about that concept. We're in the endurance world. Your audience, much of my audience, are endurance athletes, and that goes from the people who were doing 100 miles, 200 miles a week of training and doing ultramarathon competitively, ultramarathon events, all the way down to the beginners, And in order to benefit from endurance training, in order to, number one, be healthy, and number two, run your races faster, you need to develop your slow twitch mechanism, your aerobic system, as it's called, for a variety of reasons. First of all, almost all your races are going to be relatively slow, and it's, in a sense, it's why ultra races are easier, because you're running slower compared to, say, a marathon or a half marathon or 10K or 5K. I mean, as you get down to the short distances, the need to go faster increases, and it's what makes it really more difficult. That benefit comes in training, and if we bypass those slow twitch red aerobic muscle fibers, then we don't have them during our race, and it becomes a problem.
I know for me personally, just injuries out on the trail have decreased substantially because I've backed off the intensity. I'm not hammering it all the time out there, and so the joy of running and longevity is certainly there, and that's been helpful for me.
And it makes sense, because when people do get injured, it's almost always the fast twitch muscles that get injured and not the slow twitch muscles, which are really, number one, they're fatigue resistant. That doesn't mean we don't fatigue, but they're relatively fatigue resistant. And they're the muscle fibers that support our ligaments and tendons and bones and joints. And so when those muscle fibers, those slow twitch red aerobic muscle fibers, are well developed, we can correct our own injuries. We can prevent future injuries, which is huge, because the injury rate in sports, in endurance sports and in every other sport, is disgustingly high. I mean, we're talking about 50, 60, 70% or more, depending on the study and the populations.
Yeah, I recently ran the Tahoe 200 up there, and I kept my heart rate at 120 to 130 the entire the entire time, only touched 140 going up a hill, but there would be no way that I could have done that with trying to race it. I had to stay low in those heart rates and effective. At some point in one of the multiple days there, I couldn't have raised it if I wanted to. I was just, 120 was like, that's all the effort I had left. And so it was nice to keep it low and keep myself out of catastrophe, metabolic catastrophe.
Exactly.
As I say, and we've talked about this before, but I think it's worth reminding, it's counterintuitive that if you want to become faster, you need to slow down in your training. Can you talk about how that works and maybe some timing? Meaning if I'm scheduled to run, let's say, a 50K race in June of 2017, what kind of expected results can I get if I slow down now in my training?
Scott, you bring up a good point. The first point you made, which is, this seems counterintuitive. It only seems counterintuitive because we have such a screwed up society. And so we're it's bad enough that politicians do it, but the media does it all the time. Just create these images that people latch on to. And I'm thinking in particular of no pain, no gain. Mm. And I recently wrote an article about no pain, no gain as a social phenomenon. And I enlisted the help of a professor of sociology in New York, and he brought up some very good points. And we talked about the concept of no pain, no gain, going back to Benjamin Franklin in developing the concepts of capitalism. And so this is an across-the-board issue. This is not just something Jane Fonda came up with in the 80s or the running boom, brought up in the later years, or, your high school coach would discuss it. It was discussed by all those people, but corporate executives also talk about it. I worked a lot in corporate fitness for many years. We see it in colleges and universities. We see it in professional schools. Where suddenly you're exposed to twice the number of credits you've ever taken in undergraduate school, and they say, hey, no pain, no gain. Hmm. And it really affects people's health physically and biochemically and mentally. So it seems counterintuitive because we have this myth that is perpetuated continuously, it seems. To your specific question, if you've got a 50K in June of 2017, you've got more than enough time to build your aerobic system, what Arthur Lydiard first called a base, an aerobic base, between now and then. Depending on the person, depending on how trash they are or not, depending on how experienced they are or not, many people wouldn't even need that much time. It's amazing what a 3, 4, 5 month, 6 month base building period can do for the aerobic system and for an athlete. And once you have that, you should be able to run the race of your life.
No, I don't. Do you recommend throwing some speed work in with this slowing down? Do you still prescribe some track work or some just leg turnover?
Well, I'm not opposed to that. But first, you've got to have that aerobic development. And not only do you have to believe you have it, but you have to measure it somehow, because everybody thinks they have a good aerobic base, even people who can't even get out of bed in the morning because they're so trashed. So we need to see submax testing, for example, the MAF test, going to the track, running at a submax heart rate month after month, and you need to prove to yourself that you're actually running faster as the months go by, which tells you you're developing your aerobic system. And if you do that, if you build a good aerobic system, then you can, if you have time in your schedule, which rules out the vast majority of people, if you have time in your schedule to add another set of workouts, then in track workout or fartlek or hill repeats or whatever can work fine as a way to develop your anaerobic system. But I always say to people right away, realize that your race in the ultra world, your race is 99.9% aerobic. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, wouldn't you want to spend more time developing your aerobic system and less time on your anaerobic system, which could give you some benefits, but there's a risk factor associated with that from an injury standpoint.
Right.
So that's really, you know, that's really the issue. So it's a very individual thing. And I'm not, as some people think, I'm not opposed to anaerobic training, fast training. I think it should be done intelligently.
Good, good.
Is there, for each individual, and you know, everybody's different, but for each individual, is there a scale of aerobic conditioning where you can top out, where I am, you know, I'm at the peak of my aerobic capacity. I can't train any more hours and gain any more incremental aerobic capacity.
Right. Yeah. People want to bring that up because they wonder about genetics. And there's really two issues that we have to shine a light on. One is the genetic factor. The other is the lifestyle factor. And most people peak out because of lifestyle factors. They never really reach their genetic potential. At least that's what I've seen over the last, you know, nearly 40 years. And so it's the lifestyle stresses that are not being addressed that will allow the aerobic system to build further. There are certainly genetic limitations, but again, I think you see those being reached in certain people, but it's certainly the vast minority of the time. Most people are influenced more by lifestyle.
Interesting. So when we talk about slowing down and watching heart rate, we just direct people to a book, to Dr. Phil's website, 180 minus your age. And we won't make you go through all of that, Dr. Maffetone, because you've done it more than 180 times, I'm sure, and explained it. And so it's out there. It's on some older podcasts that we've had with Dr. Maffetone. But I'll tell you, it's an eye-opening. If you can still do math out there, I realize that I'm running along and I do the math and I think, you know what? I'm not 16 years old. I shouldn't be running this fast. My heart rate is too high. So it is something to watch and a fun thing to manipulate and watch as you're going down the trail.
And important for your health as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there are some of those stress lifestyle factors in the 180 minus your age formula. Yeah, some variables in there too. So,
right. The whole idea of the 180 formula is to self-assess your health and fitness and come up with a maximum aerobic heart rate, MAF heart rate, whereby at or below that heart rate, you can build your aerobic system quite well, but if you exceed it, you start becoming more anaerobic. And I sort of hate to use that word because it's really such a badly, it's just a bad word. But you end up potentially working against what you're trying to do, which is to build your aerobic system.
You sent over an email with some great topics on it. And Scott, maybe you have it in front of you. Excuse me. And you mentioned, it was a great story in there. And I forget what the context, I'm sorry, I'm doing this on, maybe I'll edit this out. What was that story about?
Or we can drift into memory and how...
my lifestyle choices and memory? Yeah. aerobic workouts and loss of...
His fictional novella came out of the Spring Million Dollar Marathon about the Tibetan shepherd.
Yes.
Yeah, about the Tibetan shepherd.
Yeah.
Let's talk about that.
Okay, sure. And by the way, I just read a great article on cognition and hydration, if you want to come back to that. Nothing new, but in the world where we're bouncing back and forth between drinking as much as possible and not drinking at all, the novella, I always wanted to write fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And I never did. I had some fiction writers who were patients of mine, and I would always ask them, where do I begin? Hmm. And they would always say, well, make sure you read all the classics. I said, well, I haven't read any of the classics. So I kind of was turned off to it. And then I was writing a book that came out a couple of years ago called The 159 Marathon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is a nonfiction book. And I thought, well, the first chapter I'm going to write, the story of someone who could break the 2-hour barrier in the marathon. What would that person be like? Where would they be from? Mm. Why would they be such a great runner? Et cetera, et cetera. And I started writing, and I got about 3,000 words, sent it to my editor, and I said, I don't know if this is something that should be part of the book. And he was astounded. He said, did you write this? Are you sure you wrote this? I said, yeah. He said, you were a different person when you wrote this. This is really great. He said, I wouldn't include it in the book because this is maybe your first fiction.
Wow.
And so it was. And I'll tell you, I never had more fun writing a book. It's a short book. It's a novella, so it's not a long read like a lot of novels. And it's about a Tibetan shepherd who's minding his own business in life, and he runs his herd. He doesn't have dogs to do the work. He runs the herd himself up into the Himalayan mountains, up to the high, 18,000 foot, or up to the, the highest pastures. Mm-hmm. And then he runs up the mountain higher, keeping an eye on his herd. He eventually, the Chinese are part of this story. The Chinese are trying to get him to join their national running team, and he doesn't want anything to do with them because his grandfather disappeared, who was also a runner. And anyway, he escapes by running across the Himalayan mountains, running through Nepal, running into India, and settling there. And he had really never heard of a marathon, but he became a marathoner, because everybody realized that he was a phenomenal runner.
Hmm. So is this available? Is it something
I just looked it up. Yeah, it's on Amazon.
Oh, great. Yeah. Okay, we'll put a link
on
it.
It's in soft physical book and also Kindle. And if you have Kindle, I don't know what the Kindle freebie thing is called, but some people have the Kindle service where they can get books for free. It's available there too. Uh-huh. And I think if you're a runner, you'll love the book. If you're not a runner, it's still going to be a fascinating story, and has a little bit of everything.
Fantastic. Okay, we'll put those in the show notes. It's always easy for me to ask Scott to do that because I don't have to do anything.
I've already written the note down. I'm a step ahead. And it's called Kindle Unlimited. You probably have that, don't you, Don?
I probably pay for it and don't even know it. Yeah. One of my many subscriptions at only $7 each. That adds up when you get a couple thousand of them monthly. Let's talk about hydration and how it affects our cognition, our ability to reason.
Yeah, you know, there have been so many different... It's almost... The hydration thing has almost been as fascinating to me as the minimalist, maximalist shoe wear, how it's gone from one to the other, back to the other. I think hydration has been the same thing. I mean, we look at Tim Noakes, who, you know, used to say you should drink a lot, and then he's saying, no, just drink when you're thirsty. So what have you found out? Is this... Are we swinging the pendulum again?
Well, yes and no. And all that you've read by people who are aware of the scientific research and clinicians who have been in the trenches with athletes, all that you've heard from them is true, even though it all conflicts. Mm. And that's because, of course, that the issue is very individual. And you can become water intoxicated, and you can become dehydrated. I think the one important thing that has come up that changed my outlook, changed Tim Noakes' outlook, and I think has changed other people's outlook as well, is the idea that when you become more than mildly dehydrated, your performance does not diminish. I think the primary issue that has really helped solidify this topic and helped organize it and helped make sense of it is the fact that, because I think in the beginning we all assumed that even a mild amount of dehydration, 1% of body weight would be a mild amount of dehydration, affects performance. And so therefore, when you're done your race, you're dehydrated, which means you couldn't drink enough water on the course to prevent that. And, you know, and I think, and there was some confirmation in that, but it was from a treadmill test in a laboratory, and that was very misleading. And it finally, it was shown that dehydration, even in moderate or higher amounts, does not affect performance. I think Tim Noakes had a study. I don't know if this has been published yet, where he showed a marathoner was running a personal best, and at the finish line, he was 10% dehydrated. Now that's pretty significant. But think about how much weight loss occurs during that amount of dehydration, and therefore how much improved running economy and therefore faster paces that runner can have. So I think the performance issue is really important. There's no place in dehydration in the course of training, in the course of the day, but in the course of a race, you want to take in as much as your body needs. And if you're a healthy runner, then you're regulating water quite well, and dehydration at a significant level is not going to affect your performance. But those are for athletes. How it affects the brain is a little different.
Yeah, let's dig into that a little bit on how it affects the brain. But one of the things, an observation that or thought I had as you were talking about this, you know, our bodies are so well designed and they can adapt to so many things. Of course, if we're expected to run across the surface of this earth, we're going to need to be able to do it without a constant aid station every 8 miles or every 6 miles. Our bodies must be built to endure a bit of
fluid loss. Yeah, I've seen 5Ks where they've had 12 water stops. You know, come on. you know, and as Tim has pointed out long ago, a big part of this problem is the industry, the water industry, selling water, which, you know, back in the 60s, we made fun of futuristic ideas, one of which was, you know, they're going to be selling water in bottles soon. Of course, that was really silly. But, you know, it's not even in the running world. I travel a good amount, and I see people clutching their water bottle. They're trying to hang on to all of their suitcases, but they've got their water bottle and they can put it up to their mouth every 14 seconds because, man, they don't want to, you know, they've just been programmed by the right. industry indirectly through the media primarily. So it's been a problem. And, the bigger problem for many runners is that their hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, their brain body regulatory mechanism, is not working well because they're under too much stress, too much physical, biochemical, and mental emotional stress. And as a result of that, their stress hormone goes up. Some of their other hormones that control fluid, that control hydration, goes down, and we no longer control hydration. And even if we drank enough water, we may not be regulated properly. And that, you know, there's an example of a lifestyle factor that is going to limit your, not just your race performance, but your training performance as well.
You said earlier 10% dehydration for this athlete. What does that mean? Can
sure,
you
that means
that is that 10%
of their
body
weight. So the difference between the starting weight and the finish line weight is 10%.
Wow. So a 150-pound runner losing 15 pounds is
correct.
Seems pretty
significant. And I would say that's an extreme. I kind of recall that athlete was down in his 130s, if not even lighter. But still, it's an extreme. You see that in the elites more because they're able to push through pain in different ways. It's one of the unique things that they have. And a lot of age groupers can do that too, but many can't. And as a result, they don't lose as much water over the course of a marathon in this case. Of course, these elites are running for a shorter period of time as well, and that makes a big difference.
So hydration day in and day out, just a person that's going to their cubicle and interacting with their phone and the computer all day long, what type of hydration tips or nuggets can you share with us?
I think
us
drinking
there?
To thirst is the perfect recommendation. You know, if you're holding your water bottle all day long, you're going to drink from it, and you're probably not going to be thirsty. So I think avoiding that, avoiding having water bottles everywhere you go, is a good idea. I think being able to read your body, being able to use instincts and intuition like every other animal on earth, who knows when it's time to take a sip of water, is really a very important way to go. And not drinking, you know, 8 or 10, 12, 15 ounces at one time.
Huh. Yeah. And diet soda, the worst thing that we could ever do to ourselves, right? Just keep reminding me.
You got it.
Actually,
the regular ones are worse, although the diet, you know, they're kind of in the same category. They're equally as bad for different reasons. But, we've developed a marketing world where liquids are, you know, they're hot. Liquid in the form of soda, liquid in the form of fruit juices, quite often diluted with synthetic vitamins added. And, of course, plain water, some of which also has synthetic vitamins added, which I always thought, boy, it gets more and more bizarre. Now they have water with synthetic vitamins in it. Amazing.
Hey, Dr. Maffetone, what do you think of carbonated water?
Ah.
You know, I know that Don was actually the one who got me started on it. And I drink a fair amount now because I'm off the juice. I'm off the Diet Coke. But I drink some carbonated flavored water, just a regular water with some carbonation and some flavor. What do you think of that?
You know, I'm a natural kind of guy. And so I drink plain. Yeah, I drink
water
plain
only.
Well water. I don't think the carbonation's a big problem. The carbonated, the naturally carbonated waters, you know, have a very, high pH, which is a nice thing to have, for the body. They're really mildly carbonated compared to the artificially carbonated ones. In terms of, the flavors that are added, frankly, I don't trust them. If you want some flavor, get your own flavor and put it in some good, healthy well water, whether it's, you know, a squeeze of lemon or some orange extract or nothing.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
Yeah, but
I think, Scott, you're
so many miles ahead of where you were.
the Diet Coke.
You know, we're talking about, you know, light years ahead. And so congratulations on that. It's a tough thing to get off. And if you do it with carbonated water.
It really is.
Yeah, there are some crazy chemicals in there that are of addictive in nature. I mean, I don't know what they're putting in there, but there's something that draws you to it.
You know, it was, I've been off for a couple of years now, and I can't remember where I was, but I said, you know what, I'm going to have a Diet Coke. And I took a sip of that, and I felt like I was drinking poison.
Yeah, you were.
It was that
bad. The taste buds change.
So, and that's thanks to you.
The taste buds change. Our set point for sweetness changes. You know, I love making my chocolate fudge because there's hardly any sweetener in it. And I know that when I make it, nobody else is going to eat it because it's too
you have more
bitter
for you.
You know, I use this bitter chocolate and it's mostly just bitter chocolate. So
when you look at an elite athlete, and what is something that separates your real elite athletes from your mid-packer and back of the packer? Is there something unique about them that almost all of them have?
You know, I don't think so. I think we're looking at two populations, which are really just one big population, and some people can run faster. And again, there could be some genetic qualities that may contribute, but I don't see it as a primary factor. I see that their lifestyle has created them as a elite athlete, and they decided they wanted to do that. They wanted to train in a way that was sort of like excessive moderation. In the ultra world, that's what you have to do, and I think some people have just been more successful at doing that.
Yeah, I think that the tribe, if you look at it as a tribe, we need some people that can go out and run fast and catch the antelope, and we need some that are not as fast but broad shoulders to carry the antelope. That's me. I'm going to be a carrier. I'm not going to be a chaser. I'm going to be a carrier.
And we need some who can run for, you know, all day long if the animal is wounded. Or, you know, I mean, I don't mind admitting to this, but when I was younger, I found the idea of chasing down deer really, really exciting. I mean, you know, I lived in the woods. There was nobody around. I could run or bike for miles in the woods off the trails. And when I ran, the deer would scatter. But when I was on my bike, they would just look at me because they couldn't see my gait as a human gait. So they really weren't bothered. But there was this idea that, you know, I think it comes from the survivalists. If you want to be prepared, you better be able to run down a deer, and you need to be fit enough to do that. Well, what happens is, because we're endurance animals, we can chase these deer and they'll sprint for 100 yards and then they'll have to rest for a few moments. And by the time they've recovered, you've caught up and now they have to sprint again. You do that for 2 hours or 3 hours and you'll be able to get to the point where they're just on the ground. They're exhausted. You could walk up and pet them. And, so yeah, we have this capability, and some people exceed with being able to run faster for longer periods than others, and you know that's the way all populations are. All populations of mammals do that as well.
I imagine that would be extremely engaging and exciting, trying to chase down a deer. I mean, my mind wouldn't be, I'm running for 2 or 3 hours. I would just be focusing on the trail itself or the wherever that deer has gone through. You'd be very, very, engaged into the process.
Boy, you're going to get some nasty emails.
Well, we just forward them to you.
Hey, you know, we are going into the fall season. Mm-hmm. I mean, the daylight hours are shrinking. One of the things that you talk about in the Big Red Book, which, by the way, just by talking to you for a few moments, I've realized that it's been a while since I've cracked that book, and I need to go and crack it and see what other things that I can learn, what gold nuggets I can get out of there. But how important is vitamin D, especially going into the fall, getting out there and being out in the sunlight? How important is that to a healthy person, and how can we get more besides just spending more time outside?
Vitamin D deficiency is one of our epidemics that's been around for a while. It's been ignored. Talking about getting nasty letters, back before email, I got a couple in the mail from the doctors of patients who I prescribed vitamin D for. It was unheard of to give a vitamin D supplement back in the 70s. That's like crazy, you know. People walk from their home to their car and they're in the sun. They get sun every day. What do you mean, you know? Well, you know, it finally became, of course, the sun phobia issue was an industry-sponsored phobia that was created back then as well. But I think today we recognize the fact that we need to have a moderate to high level of vitamin D to prevent melanoma, among other things, from a health standpoint. From a sports standpoint, good fitness requires a high, you know, not high, but an appropriate amount of vitamin D. And many people don't even come close to that. I'm shocked still today, shocked at how many athletes have even below the anemic levels that are still out there for vitamin D. I was in India recently and people were coming up to me, you know, giving me their vitamin D levels. It was more than shocking. I was astonished that some of these people were so low in vitamin D, and I wonder who's taking care of these people. We as individuals, as runners, as athletes, need to take responsibility for our own health. We can't rely on our doctors because most of them don't know what to do. So go, you know, tell your doctor you want a vitamin D test if you've not had one. This time of year, going into the fall, we're not going to be exposed to much up where you guys are. You're not going to be exposed to enough sunlight at all to get vitamin D. So that means you have to rely on what you've stored through the summer. And if you wear sunscreen or if you only train in the morning or, you know, the earlier day or later day, and you're not exposed to sun and you're, you know, afraid to go in the sun because your Uncle Joe had a melanoma, you know, you're not going to have enough. And That's a very, very important thing to do. Every runner should know his or her vitamin D levels.
So outside of going and getting a test from a doctor, are there signs or is there a way to self-diagnose whether your vitamin D levels are anemic or right in the zone?
I think, and now I'm trying to remember if the Big Red Book or the Big Yellow Book has a survey about vitamin D deficiency. There certainly is on the app. Hmm. We are developing an app, which should be out very, very soon. I keep saying that, I know. But the problem is there are so many signs and symptoms associated with vitamin D insufficiency or deficiency that it's really difficult. And without a blood test, I've just seen so many people who have a bizarre array of signs and symptoms. And when they start getting their vitamin D up, everything goes away. Or an athlete who is sort of hit a plateau and they can't get out of it. Or an injured athlete who's chronically injured and everything's been tried from a therapeutic standpoint and from a dietary standpoint and from a training standpoint. And all of a sudden they do a vitamin D test and their vitamin D level is 18 or something, which is really quite deficient. And when they start getting that up, everything falls into place and they're never injured again. Just, you know, the test is relatively easy. It's a simple blood test. It's relatively cheap. And in many states, you know, I don't keep track anymore, but in many states, you can go into a lab on your own and have this tested. And if you can't, go to your doctor and say, I want a vitamin D test.
So if let's say I had the test and I need more vitamin D, and I want to get outside and run instead of running at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to go out and run when the sun comes up and be out there in the sun. If I put sunscreen on, does that decrease my absorption capabilities
of
vitamin D?
Significantly.
So you're saying run naked.
Run naked, yeah.
Without any
sunscreen. Your logo is the naked. Lou, I don't know if you realize that. yes. It's time to get over the sun phobia. Look what it's created. Among other things, it's created a higher number of people with skin cancer because their vitamin D levels are so low. So, you know, let's spend time in the sun intelligently, not get burned. So you don't want to go out midday in July and do a 3-hour run, you know, with minimum clothing because you're going to get burned. So, you know, we don't want to be burned. That's when you get into trouble. But at this time of year, if your vitamin D is below normal range, you're not going to be able to get it up to normal by going out in the sun this time of year because you're not going to get enough. So therefore, you're going to have to supplement. And for many people, their vitamin D levels are so low that even supplementing and being in the sun doesn't budge those levels because they're almost pathologically low. I hate to use that phrase, but I think it's a good one. And it means that you've got to see your doctor and you might need an injection of vitamin D because there's often no other way to get that vitamin D level up.
A few years back, I was running with Gordy Ainsley, and we all know that name. And one of the things he said is, Don, you need to take your shirt off. You need to get some sun. Don't be afraid of that stuff. It'll save you.
Yeah.
And that always stuck with me. But, you know, I don't have Gordy's body, so I didn't really take my shirt off in front of him. But it's he knows the value of it. So often you'll see him running without a shirt.
You know, you mentioned supplements, like just going to the local drugstore and getting a vitamin D pill.
Yeah,
is
the most
that
effective
the kind of supplement
ones are
or?
Fish-based, so a cod liver oil rather than a plant-based. So the cod liver oil is a vitamin D3. The plant-based, which is not as well absorbed, is vitamin D2. And we really don't, unless we eat polar bear liver or that kind of stuff, there's really no foods that have natural.
Yeah, that's not my grocery store.
There's really not any foods that have vitamin D levels of any significance. You know, sure, if you drink a quart of milk, you're going to get 400 units. That's a completely worthless amount for most people. So our reliance has to be the sun. If that doesn't do it, if we can't get the vitamin D level to the appropriate levels, then we have to add supplementation.
What about the people that are like in England, where they're well known for having overcast most of the time, or at least that's what I'm told.
Alaska, where it's dark 20 hours a day.
You really need to take a look at your vitamin D levels if you're in that type of environment.
Without a doubt. And you know, the natural Eskimos, you know, the Indians up north, the people who live in northern Europe and, you know, the far south, they will eat fish livers and get some vitamin D and vitamin A and get adequate amounts of it. But, you know, it's not something people like.
There's a number of – I'm sorry about that, Phil. I spoke over you there. There are a great number of benefits to cod liver oil or fish oil and for the joints. And I think – and I need to get back on that. And I believe you'll talk me into it in just about two sentences, Dr. Maffetone. Why should I be opening my cupboard and taking out the fish oil again?
Two kinds of fish oil. There's one kind of fish oil that contains two important fatty acids, EPA and DHA. And these are omega-3 fats, which are not found in plant foods like flax. These are fatty acids that regulate our inflammatory mechanism. So they help us make anti-inflammatory hormones. They're important because when we train, we produce inflammatory hormones. And the whole game of recovery is balancing our inflammation and anti-inflammation from a chemical standpoint. And we don't, you know, humans evolved at the sea and we ate a lot of fish and we ate it raw, but we don't do that anymore. And most of the fish we get doesn't contain EPA and DHA because it's either farmed fish or it's not from those cold northern waters where we get like the good salmon from the far northwest. And then when we do get that, we overcook it or we cook it and we destroy a lot of that. So the supplementing of EPA, DHA is a very important thing, I would say, for most people. The other fish oil supplement is what we just talked about, the cod liver oil as a source, a high-quality source of vitamin D.
Do you have to guard against getting some substandard or not very efficient, effective fish oils? Are there some better than others we should be careful
about? Yeah, I think these days we're protected fairly well. What I would avoid is going into a store and looking for the cheapest vitamin D. They're sometimes at the end of their expiration date. They're sometimes made by companies that are no longer in business. There are quality issues, and if you stick with a well-known company, those quality issues are addressed, and we get a fish oil that is of high quality because they're able to take out the toxins that almost all fish have because our oceans are polluted.
So we've been pretty productive on this podcast, where right now people have slowed down while they're running. They've torn their shirts off so they can get a little sun, which is going to be cool. They're going,
especially the women.
They're getting some vitamin D tests going on, and then right to the health food store to get their supplements. So it's a good thing that we don't have any topics when we talk to Dr. Maffetone. They just kind of all jump out at us. And Scott, that was a great question on vitamin D. You're holding back on that.
Well, no, I was motivated at the start of this to break open that red book. Yeah. And I happen to have a electronic copy on my computer, and I started looking through there, and I thought, I don't think we've ever talked about vitamin D.
Huh.
I mean, I think we have with Gordy, because Gordy actually says the best way to, if I recall, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, maybe someone else said this, but he said the best way to keep you from getting sunburned is to start out in the spring and get out there a little bit of a time and develop a really deep tan.
Yeah.
And then you won't have that sunburn.
Well, you know,
issue.
I was on the Golf Channel with David Ledbetter many, many years ago. And I said, the best way to avoid getting a burn is to develop a good tan. Well, man, did they get so many calls, slow mail, and email from dermatologists, especially. And the the producer, when he would call me, he would laugh and say, "Yeah, well, you got seven more this week." but yes, that's how we protect ourselves, by having darker skin. And that's the good news. A little bit of bad news is that the darker our skin, the more difficult it is to get vitamin D, because we need to literally be in the sun longer to get the same amount of vitamin D. But I think if you it's a lot easier to maintain a proper level of vitamin D than try to catch up, because you've let your vitamin D levels get so low. And Don, you didn't mention that people now out on the trail are dumping out their water because they don't need it. most of them, they want to have better running economy, and they're, they want to lose that 1 pound.
Yeah, well,
I was gonna say one of the evolutions in our running, and my running, and even Don's. I remember, we used to go out on this 8 mile loop that we normally do, and I remember not too long ago where we would both take two handheld bottles with us on this 8 mile loop, and now I still take a handheld water bottle on it, but I ended up I end up at the end of the run, and I think, why do I carry this thing? I didn't drink any of it. And
well,
I just think that's a testament to some of the stuff that we've learned from you.
Is gradually pour a little bit out each day and until it's empty. And then when it's empty, you're not going to have the weight factor. Of course, you're going to still be affecting your gait, because your brain is going to know that there's this thing in your hand. Oh, it doesn't weigh much. It has an effect on. And by the way, you forgot to ask me about cognitive function and hydration.
Oh yeah, let's get to that. We didn't get to the cognitive part.
I was slightly dehydrated.
Oh, were you? You forgot?
Yeah.
how does hydration affect cognition?
We knew this long, long ago that kids in school who are dehydrated. It shows up in a very obvious way. It shows up in college kids, but it shows up in an obvious way in older adults who are said to have, these senior moments, who are said to have mild cognitive dysfunction, who were said to have memory loss, or early, not technically early Alzheimer's, but, because they start forgetting things, they worry about, having Alzheimer's. And there were never really any studies about it. And when the overhydration issue hit, this issue kind of got lost completely by a lot of clinicians. But the fact is, a lot of people have a cognitive impairment because they're mildly dehydrated. And this recent study from the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, which I think was last month's edition, and I'm a little behind on my reading. So, but I think it's last month. And what they showed was that dehydration, even less than 1%, impairs cognition. And this is significant. And so here's from a clinical standpoint, here's what happens. Older people are much more vulnerable because their body doesn't work as well. Their metabolism is not as efficient. But we're all potentially affected by this. But what happens is if you're 60 years old, 70 or 80 years old especially, and you're going to go out shopping, you've learned to not drink any water that day because you don't want to have to find a bathroom. Mm. If you're going to go for a car ride, if you're going to go on a trip, whether you have water with you or not, bladder function, kidney function, there's more and more dysfunction with age. And so people have learned just intuitively, just by trial and error, that if they don't drink any water or they don't drink as many fluids, they're not going to be stuck having to find a bathroom and risk having to pull off the road on a highway, which you see all the time. It's often with these 3-year-old kids, but I saw in my drive across country last week, I saw four adults on the highway urinating. One was a woman. But I think we have a big problem with cognitive impairment in the elderly, and in many cases it's due to a dehydration. And when you become dehydrated at less than 1% body weight, boy, that's easy to do. You can do that in a half a day by restricting fluid. And I just remember being in practice and making these recommendations that people figure this issue out. If you're going to shop, if you're going on a road trip, if you're doing this, figure out how you could not be dehydrated. And most people can do that, and they're amazed. More importantly, their kids or their spouse or their friends are amazed at how much better their brains work as a result of this.
Yeah, we sabotage ourselves quite a bit with sleep and the wrong food or skipping meals or, whatever it might be. There's a lot of ways to go around at 80% of your potential.
These are the lifestyle factors that we touched on earlier as being more important than genes, because we're so badly influenced by them because of the bad habits, often that we thrust upon ourselves, but sometimes that are thrust upon us via the industries who are spending millions, billions of dollars to tell us to do bad things to our bodies.
You've given us a lot of great time and a lot of great topics and discussion points. I want to hit just on one more, if I can, since we have people throwing their shirts off and spilling their water. The many things that we find on the aid station tables have high processed sugars and refined sugars on them, and we fuel ourselves with those. And earlier you were talking about the cod liver oil or the fish oil being an anti-inflammatory and having those properties, whereas these refined sugars are really creating a great deal of inflammation within us, I believe. We've learned that from you. So can you kind of guide us into that space of what should we avoid that stuff and what should we replace it if we're coming up on an aid station table and we want to keep that inflammatory process at a minimum?
Yeah, when we look at fat burning and wanting to avoid things like sugar, which impair fat burning, and the balance of inflammatory chemicals that we have to juggle all the time, we really don't include the nutrient we take during a race, because it doesn't really have an impact like it does when we're just hanging out and not training or not racing. So the only problem, first of all, many people can't run very far without without eating or drinking something. And that's a problem because they're not burning enough fat. So that has to change. You should be able to go out and do 2, 3, 4 hours, 5 hours. I talked to Zach Bitter the other day and Bitterman the other day. And right. he, you know, he said he could do 5 or 6 hours without anything. So
I'm sure he can. Yeah. So I think
people need to first develop their fat burning so they could do that. Then when you get into a race, you're burning your maximum amount of fat. Then you can literally supplement with a carbohydrate substance to maintain your fat burning, which is what it'll do. And now you got the best of both worlds. The problem is most of the products that are used in races, most of the products that are in the marketplace are disaccharide or polysaccharide sugars. They're starches or they're two sugar molecules, disaccharides like sucrose, as opposed to monosaccharides like honey or fruit juice. And when you consume a disaccharide or a polysaccharide, you have to digest it before you could utilize that sugar. And in order to digest it, the first stage of digestion for sugars is in the mouth. And how many people chew their liquid when they're in a race? Not too many.
Yeah.
And if they do, they might be taken off the course for cognitive impairment. So as a result, what I'm getting at, as a result, is undigested disaccharide and polysaccharides are going to give you a lot of gut stress. You're going to have upper GI gas, lower GI gas, gas in between. You're going to potentially vomit as a result. You're going to have diarrhea as a result. You're going to have cramps as a result. And these are very serious problems in runners during races. So that can all be prevented. And I have an article I just got accepted in a medical journal along with Paul Larson on a Ironman triathlete and how she changed her diet and how it affected her race ability, how it improved her race, but how it reduced her need for calories during the race and how it eliminated her very severe, we're talking about very serious gastrointestinal problems, projectile vomiting and blood in the urine and bloody diarrhea. Those are serious problems in runners. And how yes. just by switching to the right carbohydrate product, that all that went away. We're talking about 18 years of that gut distress, and it went away the first race season after making changes over the winter. So that publication doesn't come out till July, but the journal actually gave me permission to post it on my website, so you can find it there.
Fantastic. It is. Is that on there now? Okay.
If you like what you're hearing and you wish this podcast would go on and on like I do, but it's impossible to do that, you can find all of this stuff on his website, in his books. These topics have been written about and they're out there for you to study. So we thank you for all those resources, Dr. Maffetone, and the time that you come on here to volunteer and share those things with us. It's changed Scott and I's
Thanks,
running.
Don.
I know that.
Thanks, Don and Scott.
And I think
it's just so much fun to talk to you guys.
Awesome. Well, we feel the same. I mean, I don't like talking
miss
to Scott much.
Dry
but.
Humor. That's what I like. I notice that you get my dry humor because I notice you have to take a sip of your water whenever.
Hey, so we always end one of our podcasts with some of your new music. Has there been any new music that's come out lately that we should know
about?
Gosh,
I just released a single called Too Old to Lie, but it's not one of those, upbeat kind of songs that you would want on your podcast. So my last album has a song called Kissin' Cousins. You know, we're all cousins. And so I wrote a song called Kissin' Cousins, and it's one of those upbeat, you know, run along kind of song. So you can grab that from my website, maffetonemusic.com, and use it as you like.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll do that. We'll close this with Kissin' Cousins by Dr. Phil Maffetone.
Yeah.
Now go out and listen.
And kiss.
Moms.
So now they've got their shirts off, their water bottles empty, and they're kissing. That's pretty good.
And they're kissing. On another podcast, I noticed that there's a chapter at the end of one of your books about sex, having lots of sex.
Healthy sex. It's in the red book.
Keeps your test.
And by the way, if you're confused by all the books that we've talked about and you're an endurance runner, the primary book that has everything is the big yellow book, big book of endurance training and racing. The big red book came along after that, and it has a lot more lifestyle factors. One of the differences, for example, is it has the chapter, whole chapter, called Healthy Sex.
Well, people need to get both of them, and so just don't order one. Get them both.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
they're great.
They're kissing cousins.
I like that.
I kept that last part on there, so we'll have all of that to help push people more to some of those books. I'll cut that off that part off.
Hey, so when is the app going to be out? Do you have any kind of time frame? I think we were talking about
talked. So we've done a number of beta tests along the way. We've gotten great feedback from a lot of our testers, both people who are familiar with MAF and those who are not. And you know, we just keep saying, hey, wouldn't it be great if we can have this little thing as part of it? And so, of course, you know, they put that in, and then we want to test it on, you know, the internal group of us, and we do that, and next thing you know, it's 3 weeks later. I probably shouldn't say anything, but it's going to be soon. And if you go to the website, you'll see mention of the app, and we'll be releasing some articles that talk about the app. Basically, the app allows you to do what an athlete patient was doing when they would come to my clinic. I would do a very extensive oral history about, you know, all their health and fitness life, and by asking a lot of very, very important questions. And so that's what this app does. It drives the process. It's very it's a very intelligent thing, and then it gives you specific recommendations based on the input that you've given it. Given dietary recommendations, exercise recommendations, and so forth.
That sounds like a great resource. You've been on Brad Kern's podcast a couple times. He's a local guy here in our area, and well-known triathlete, and he's doing some good stuff over there. I really like his podcast and his fat burning.
I just heard from him right before we went on the air, and we are set up to do a podcast again soon. Yeah, I've known Brad
good,
forever.
Good. Tell him way
back. You know, when he was young in the sport as a pro.
Yeah,
we've had him here in the studio and done a podcast with him. Yep. He's a fun guy.
He's a character, and he spoke a long time ago about you know, slow down and then race it on Sunday. It's, you know, run slow during the week and then just tear it up on race day.
Yeah, you know,
we had
a follow up article. If there's time for a very quick story, it's not just that.
Yeah, we're recording.
you know, we did a follow-up article on the Tarahumara Indians. I guess we've maybe done two or three of those. And we found out that they don't run a whole lot. They actually walk a whole lot more than they run. And they run mostly when there's a race. And so I was really, I was unaware of that. And I was just amazed. And it didn't surprise me. I think that we all have the capability, if we've done this our whole life, if we've spent a lot of time walking great distances and then we want to jump into a race, we can do that, we can still get really good at racing by doing that. And, you know, and here they are doing that. I mean, the point of the article was to bring to light that these are not gods. I think people are worshiping the Tarahumara Indians because they think they are these great human beings. They're a very unhealthy population. And but I just found that very interesting that they mostly race on race day. I mean, they mostly run on race day.
Hmm. Yeah, so that's full circle. That's where we started the podcast. Yep. Slow down and be confident that you can race just by training your, you know, aerobic system. Yeah, because we're using our aerobic system when we're doing these races. So
we're using it's just, our it's aerobic nice. System right now.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's why I have my 20-ounce water bottle next to me, and I'm constantly pouring it in. I'm about to take my shirt off and open the door so I can get some sun on me. Dr. Phil, let's make sure we do this again. Not wait so long. It's always a lot of fun for us too, and we learn a lot. I'm going to start taking some of these, you know, cod liver oil. I'm going to get back on that train.
Sounds good to me.
Be healthy.
Thank you very much.
We're not sisters, not even brothers. Seems everyone persists to hate the other. Must be the human, ain't all that wise, 'cause none of us are satisfied. We are not sisters, ain't even brothers, but all insist we're not the other. Must be the human is just the same. Caress the cat, ignore the monkey that's on our back. It's just the human who wants to change it. Ah, the game within a game.